This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. It is Friday. It's our health and living segment. And you know who's in the studio. He hasn't gone on holiday for a while. But, you know, thank you for coming again, Dr. George Lee.
Absolute pleasure.
How are you today?
I'm good. I had a bit of withdrawal from last week. You didn't have a show last week.
No, we didn't.
No. It is as usual. You know, Friday, it's raining outside. Yes. And then, you know, everyone's staying cozy. And we're going to talk about something quite important, quite revolutionary.
Yes. Well, we, you know, it's a breath test that we're going to be talking about.
Absolutely.
For the first time, it has nothing to do with... You just came running in, didn't you? Okay. We are discussing an early study which shows that a simple breath test could help predict whether people with gut problems are at high risk of developing stomach cancer. I wish it were as easy as it sounds, but, you know, in the studio with us to tell me whether this is going to be a possible reality is Dr. Mahendra Raj, a consultant gastroenterologist. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mahendra. How are you today?
I'm fine, Meera. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
You're most welcome. I mean, George, you know, welcomes people to share the limelight every now and again. So
occasionally,
you get a little bit of the limelight.
All right, okay. We're going to tackle fame
is fine for you.
Yeah, just don't make it a habit. I mean, what came to mind, Dr. Mahendra, because endoscopies to me sometimes. Yes. You know, I always think about it and I say, gosh, how do they put this probe down my throat, you know, to try and, you know, get to doing a scope. And when I saw a breath test, does it sound as simple? Is it as simple as
it's too good to be true, right?
It's too good to be true.
Yeah, you know what? This paper was actually published in a fairly reputable gastroenterology journal called GUT, which is the official journal of the Gastroenterology Society of the Great Britain. And because of that, I think we have to take this paper a little bit more seriously than most ideas which are brandished out in the press. And essentially, what a group of researchers from Latvia and Israel have done was to devise a test which enables them to diagnose gastric cancer, or for that matter, even changes in the lining of the stomach which predispose to gastric cancer based on a breath test. Mm. The concept actually is very similar to the breathalyzer test, which the cops use to catch drunken drivers or people drive over the limit of alcohol. It's a very interesting concept. It's based on the principle that gastric cancer cells produce small amounts of substances which are called volatile organic compounds, or VOCs in short. And basically, these are compounds which at room temperature are volatile. They're in the gaseous form. So when these products or substances are produced by the cancer cells, they find their way into the circulation and they find their way into the lung, patient blows out, you collect that breath in a little container, like a bag or some other container, and then you subject that breath to analysis using fairly complicated technology, and then voila, you come out with a diagnosis. The good thing about this paper is that it was quite rigorously done. So there is credibility in the paper. But needless to say, I mean, we have to look at it in perspective. It's still considered preliminary data. So a lot has to be done before this test actually finds prime time. I mean, the results have to be reproduced and validated on thousands of patients all over the world before they can actually become readily recommended for general use.
So are you saying that cancer cells release some kind of gas?
Yes, they do. Yes, so that's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah.
So then why only
the cancer cells.
Yeah, why only just stomach cancer?
Well, I mean, interesting things that you know, Meera has previously done some shows on dog sniffing some sort of the urine.
Prostate
there's
cancer.
A specific smell right. to detect prostate cancer. We have got, you know, if you look at the data, you have lung cancer will release some sort of smell. Yep. What is this about smell? It's like, you know, somehow something.
We have underestimated the power of our breath.
It's like, you know, is this kind of pie in the sky. What's going on?
It's an ancient medical tradition, isn't it, George, that the patient's breath often gives you the diagnosis of a
disease. What are you trying to say is that we need to sniff the patient?
So maybe we have to go back and learn from our historical forefathers.
Yes.
I mean, look, everyone knows that, you know, people who have this condition called diabetic ketoacidosis.
Oh, right, okay.
They have this typical acetone smell in the breath. People with cirrhosis of the liver and end-stage liver failure have a characteristic smell in their breath. So, you know, I mean, this is a concept which, and it's been it's established in scientific fact now, but this concept has probably been something which has been going on for centuries.
Well, I mean, forgive my ignorance. I said, what sort of like ancient literature actually say that, you know, making diagnosis apart from ketoacidosis, that, you know, you can use breath to in order to detect diseases?
I mean, look, liver failure.
Right.
Liver failure. There's a characteristic breath smell in patients with end-stage liver failure or dying of cirrhosis, end-stage cirrhosis. People who have renal failure are supposed to have that fishy odor in their breath due to the accumulation of urea and ammonia in blood. So these are just a few examples. And this is all anecdotal experience from people who have been practicing medicine over centuries.
It's validated with the form of VOC.
Yeah, absolutely. And now they can put a number on it. They can use a machine to measure it and put a number on the amounts of this stuff, which is... We don't understand all the biology of it, but obviously cells have complicated metabolic pathways. And when cells become cancerous cells, sometimes something goes haywire. So the substances which are produced by these abnormal cells are different from the normal cells. So if you have technology, and in this particular instance, the technology which is used is two types. One is something called gas chromatography and mass spectroscopy. And these are phrases which are more familiar among chemists and physicists than doctors. And the other is something called nanoarray analysis.
Yeah, I saw a lot of that word.
Yeah, using
over the
this
place.
Thing called nanotechnology. I'm a physics illiterate. But basically, nanotechnology involves the study of very small particles, such as atoms and molecules, and they have complicated machinery which can then characterize the different atoms and the different patterns of atoms which are produced by these cells and give you like a signature for the cancer. And that's what's done in this.
The breath signature. My goodness.
So we're barking on the wrong tree so far. Yeah, because so far all the diagnosis has been biopsy, tissues, and also blood tests. And then it is literally a breath of fresh air, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Two things. One is, you know, the only time I've heard of volatile organic compounds is in waste management.
Sure.
In the area of waste management. I've not, brought the VOC into a medical context in all this time. And is there a link?
Well, you know, it's a concept. Volatile organic compounds simply means substances which at room temperature are gases. And different substances undergoing different forms of fermentation or metabolism will produce different gases. And if you have a sophisticated piece of equipment which can then characterize these various, as it were, smells, and it's interesting, the nanoarray analysis, one kind of anecdotal or affectionate term for it is e-nose or electrical nose. So it's basically a nose. It's an electronic nose which picks up smells. And it's not smells which can be discerned by our ordinary noses. It's using complicated technology which picks up small little variations in these substances and creates a signature. The concept is fascinating.
And he said he's physics illiterate. You lost us a long time ago.
No, he didn't lose me.
He lost me. Right. Okay. But, you know, the interesting thing is that how medicine has evolved in that direction. I really think it's very exciting. I mean, when I discuss with Mira about these two, this particular topic, number one is that we begin to see these kind of divergence of diagnostic tests because it simply needs to be non-invasive. Yes. Then people will come forward for it. So it's exciting. So, you know, smelling the urine, smelling breath tests and things like that. But also the other things which a lot of my patients, when they come forward, they ask for certain breath tests associated with H. pylori and also stomach cancer. I'm intrigued by stomach cancer. And this is something that I really hope the Klang Valley listeners, perhaps you are concerned about stomach cancer or anything like that, should call in.
Yes, our phone number is 0377 109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 0162 019000. Anything to do with gastric cancer, stomach cancer, your gut, basically. Sorry, you were saying.
Yeah, just to temper my initial enthusiasm and exhilaration about this, I think while this publication is fascinating, there's a long, long, long way to go before we can tell our listeners out there to rush to the nearest hospital to get this gastric cancer breath test.
But why?
Why? Two things. Number one, any test has to be validated on a much larger scale before it can become accepted. That's called reproducibility. All right, that's a very important concept in medicine and in science in general. Secondly, the equipment which is used for these tests is not something which is generally available in your medical laboratories, in hospitals, or even in, you know, in the city. You know, these are sophisticated pieces of equipment which are normally present in departments of chemistry or research pharmacology laboratories in the universities. Mm-hmm. That's when we talk about the gas chromatography bit. The nanoarray technology, I don't know whether we have that kind of technology even here in Malaysia, actually.
Very sophisticated chemistry.
Do we have existing technology now that's being used in hospitals for using the breath analysis diagnose?
We have breath analysis, but not this kind of breath analysis.
Okay.
For example, there's a very widely used breath test to diagnose the presence of this bacteria called Helicobacter pylori, which is a bacteria found in the stomach of half the world's population. And it's very interesting to bring it up because this bacteria is supposed to be one of the major causes of gastric cancer. So we've got that kind of breath test, but not the kind of breath tests which will diagnose gastric cancer tomorrow.
Okay, so I can come and do a breath test to check for H. pylori.
You certainly could.
Would
you like to tell
how
the listeners?
How accurate is that?
Yeah, okay.
Is that accurate?
Yes, the urea breath test is a very accurate test. Any test, no matter how good, has got what we call false positives or false negatives. But by and large, it's a good test. There are certain circumstances which limit the accuracy of the test. For example, if the patient has been on taking antibiotics for a cough or a cold or whatever in the last few weeks, then that performance of the test is blunted a little bit. Mm-hmm. But given these little limitations, by and large, it's a good test.
Okay. I've always been concerned about H. pylori.
Yeah, okay.
Because I remember doing a show a long time ago about how many of us have it and we don't realize
it. Yeah, because you said half of the world population.
Yes, absolutely right.
See, George, I know how George's mind moves.
That's right.
The minute he knows he's at risk of contracting anything,
he gets excited.
Panics.
And he asks many questions.
We could spend 2 hours talking about H. pylori. It's a fascinating bug.
Really? Yeah. And you've done a lot of research on that. Why is it fascinating?
It's a fascinating bug because, number one,
it's a bacteria.
It's a bacteria, yes. It's a bacteria which infects half the world's population. That means one in two human beings in this world has the bug.
One of us, one amongst the three of us has it.
In the stomach. Fortunately, in Malaysia, it's probably true to say, probably somewhere between 15 and 20% of people may have this bug. Whereas in places like China and the Indian subcontinent, in the cities, up to 70% of people may have this bug.
Why is that? So it's ethnically based?
That? Now, it's a $6 million question. This bug has evolved with mankind over thousands of years, all right? So it's been intimately linked with man. Why is it some communities have a very high prevalence and some communities have a very low prevalence? It's not entirely certain, but certainly it's got to do with socioeconomic conditions. By and large, not all the time, but by and large, nations which have a lower socioeconomic milieu have a higher prevalence of H. pylori. As societies become more affluent, the H. pylori prevalence rate in that population generally declines. And there are some very interesting exceptions to this rule, but this is the general rule. And one of the exceptions actually is probably in Malaysia. In Malaysia, there's a very, very striking ethnic difference in the prevalence of H. pylori. Mm-hmm. It's been shown for many years now, and we showed it as well, that the Malay population in Malaysia has an exceptionally low prevalence of H. pylori.
Wow.
I did some work in Kelantan. We all know, of course, that Kelantan is a predominantly Malay population, more than 95% of the population.
George comes from there. And he makes up the minority of the population.
1.6% of it.
We've got something in common. Orang Kelantan, as they say.
Oh, both of you.
Are you kidding?
No, right. I worked there for 13 years. I worked there for 13 years.
You know what Kelantanese call this? Kelantan celuk.
Kelantanese wannabe.
That's right.
So the Malay population has a very low prevalence of H. pylori, and the prevalence of gastric cancer in Kelantan is probably the lowest recorded in the world.
Right.
And H. pylori, of course, as you know, predisposes not just to gastric cancer, but also to ulcer disease. And ulcer complications in Kelantan are extremely low. We found that when I first arrived in Kelantan.
And I always thought that Kelantanese are more relaxed. That's why they have no ulcer problems.
No, I think it's all to do with H. pylori. When I first arrived in Kelantan in 1988 as a gastroenterologist, I was wondering how come there's so few ulcer complications. And only later it became obvious that the reason for that was because H. pylori was not common there.
I mean, so you didn't have a lot of work then?
No, we had a lot of other work. We had a lot of other work.
So you need to do a lot of breath tests. That's right.
It's very interesting. We have Dr. D on the line. You have a question?
Hello, hi. I'm a GP. Yes. I just would like to know about H. pylori. I know like the success rate for the current triple therapy that we use is about, if I'm not mistaken, about 75% to 80%. And I'm just wondering what happens to those patients who, you know, despite multiple triple therapies and repeated antibiotic treatments, and we still get a positive urea breath test. What do we do, and what are their risk of developing gastric CA and all of that?
Fantastic question.
Okay, thank you very much, Malika. Our line here isn't very good. I'm going to... Dr. George is actually going to repeat that question. Oh, Malika, can you call us back? Because the line wasn't very good.
Okay. Well, essentially, Dr. D was telling us that, of course, she treats many patients with positive breath tests and
absolutely,
then with triple therapy. Yep. And then she believes that the success rate is about 70%. And then what do you do with that 30% who don't get who don't get eradicated with H. pylori? And what are their risk of getting stomach cancer and ulcerations?
Yeah. Look, it's becoming a very medical talk here. I mean, I hope you listen.
Well, there are many people go for these screening tests.
Absolutely. Yes. So maybe I should answer the second part of the question first. And what happens if they are not eradicated?
Yeah, because half of populations have got it.
We've got to have this whole thing in perspective. Look, H. pylori is an important cause of gastric cancer and ulcer disease, but it's also important to realize that the vast majority of infected patients do not get gastric cancer or ulcers. It just so happens that if you have the bug, you have a 6 to 8 times higher risk of getting gastric cancer than someone who doesn't have the bug. But if the overall risk is not very high, then even if you have H. pylori, the risk is not enormous.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Again, let's use some Malaysian figures just to put it in perspective. The risk of gastric cancer, the incidence of gastric cancer among, say, Malays in Kelantan is about 1 per 100,000.
Okay, that's
per
very
year,
low.
Which means that of 100,000 people in Kelantan, one person will get gastric cancer per year.
Right.
All right. Now, the risk among the Chinese population is about males. I'm talking about males now. We've got to
differentiate between the genders.
It's about 11 per 100,000.
Okay.
So that's considerably higher, right? But 11 per 100,000 is still 11 per 100,000. It's not 100 per 100,000. So the overall risk of gastric cancer is not exceedingly high.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So the majority of patients who are not treated for H. pylori will not get gastric cancer.
That's true.
Which brings us into a dilemma which many doctors have, and that is who to treat. Now, there are certain groups of patients whom all doctors and experts would agree should be treated. Someone who has already got an ulcer. There's no question you should get rid of the bug and do whatever you can to get rid of the bug. Now, how would you cope with a patient who, because he's got very health conscious attitude, goes to a hospital, gets an H. pylori test, he's got no symptoms whatsoever, he's found to have H. pylori infection, then he asks the doctor, should I be treated? You know, it's not always a very easy answer to this question.
Because this is happening every day with people going into
absolutely right.
these screening tests.
Absolutely. This is a dilemma that many doctors face. And, you know, there are some guidelines. There's Asia-Pacific guidelines, European guidelines, even American guidelines. And, you know, when it comes to this particular issue, the guidelines are a bit wishy-washy. They say, talk to the patient.
So the ball is in the patient's court, right?
Talk to the patient and form a consensus with the patient and then decide whether he needs treatment or not.
I want
that,
the treatment.
That gives you an indication of how much uncertainty there is. But, you know, and like everything in medicine, there are advocates who strongly say,
eradicate this.
The only good H. pylori is a dead H. pylori.
Okay.
And there are people who say, look, we can't be eradicating this bug which has lived with man for so long, it might even have some beneficial effects in the majority. So that's a kind of dilemma which...
Well, let's start from the beginning. Let's say if I go to a screening test and then I get a blood test that says that I've got H. pylori antibodies positive. Yes. What does that mean?
We'll come back and get Dr. Mahendra Raj to answer that. If you have a question, we're discussing stomach cancer, H. pylori, everything else to do with... You know, it started with the conversation about a breath test that could possibly detect stomach cancer, precancerous cells. We'll come back and discuss that as well. Our phone number is 0377 10 9000. You can tweet VFM Radio or text 0162019000. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with us for his weekly show. And
to get medical advice for myself too.
Yes, gastroenterologist in the studio, Dr. Mahendra Raj. We're discussing stomach cancer in view of recent studies that show that a simple breath test can help predict people with gut problems. And we left off talking about H. pylori. Malika had a question just now. The first part of the question, would you like to answer?
Very specifically, Malika, if this standard clarithromycin-containing triple therapy doesn't work, then there are other what we call rescue regimes to be used. And the number of rescue regimes, some of them involve taking four drugs for up to 2 weeks, and some of them involve using antibiotics as alternatives to clarithromycin, one of which is levofloxacin. There are a lot of details to that. I'm not sure this is an appropriate place to go to all the details, but there are what we call second-line rescue regimes to take care of those patients. But even then, there's no guarantee, of course, that the patient will become eradicated.
Okay. Roy, your question?
Afternoon, Roy.
Hi, yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
All right. Just very quickly, I'll hang up immediately. Could it be possible that the reason why these Clantanese folk have such a low reported level of cancer, et cetera, is because they drink a different sort of water than the rest of us here in Malaysia?
Roy, it's probably the voodoo that we eat that killed off all the H. pylori.
Thank you very much, Roy. You know, so how much of it is diet, that kind of thing?
That's a fascinating question, Roy, and that's a question which many people have grappled with in Malaysia. And the honest answer is, at this particular moment, all answers are still purely speculative. There could be a number of reasons. Number one, there could be some genetic factor within the Malays which prevent this bug from taking hold in the stomach. There's something about the immune system or the lining of the stomach which just makes it hard for the H. pylori bug to actually latch onto the stomach lining and remain there for years. Or it could be the voodoo. Maybe it is the voodoo which just kills off all the bacteria.
Maybe you want to shed some more light on what voodoo really is for those of us who don't come from Kelantan.
Actually, I have no idea what voodoo is.
It's a kind of an anchovy sauce with a very fishy anchovy sauce.
But which absolutely is delicious.
Pungent, but absolutely delicious. Yes.
Okay. You're not Malaysian, you don't even know what voodoo is.
I do. I haven't been to
You're going to get people calling in to tell you what voodoo is now.
Thank you.
So coming back to
do a show on Buddha.
Oh no, Buddha! That's
and George will lead it.
That's right, I'll lead it.
You had a question.
That's right. You know, actually, you know, one of the reasons why I really am fascinated about this is because I am the I've had the blood tested and it's positive. I don't know what it means. And also, I want to know. That's right.
And
it's H. pylori positive. Yeah. And then so, and then the next step. So, what does that exactly mean?
Right.
What
Stay away from me. Well,
that's right.
See, the blood test is okay as a test as far as it goes, but unfortunately, there are many false positives and false negatives with this blood. Firstly, if the blood test kit is something which has already been validated in the local population and it's positive, all that means is that you've been exposed to the bacteria at some point in your life. It could mean that the bacteria was there and has since been eradicated.
Okay.
Or it could mean that you have active infection. Or it could mean that it's a false positive, which means that you don't have the bug at all. So the blood tests have limitations, but even if your blood test is positive, then the next step is to ask yourself whether you want to know whether you have H. pylori infection. Mm-hmm. And if the answer to that is yes, I do want to know whether I have H. pylori infection, then you need to do another test.
Okay, if George is positive, right, and it's not posing a problem, i.e. you don't have any of the symptoms which could mean that George has a stomach problem, can you just leave it?
That's a $6 million question. You know, the gastroenterologist is probably the last person to ask that question. Why? Because I can only answer that question maybe from my own personal perspective. If I had the bacteria, looking at all the evidence so far now, I probably would like to get rid of it.
Okay, right. So let's say if I want to get rid of it. So how do I, from blood tests, move on to find out how sensitive when do I go for the breath test?
Look, if your blood test is positive and you want to know whether you have bacteria or not, do a breath test.
Okay.
That's pretty accurate.
Right. How accurate is pretty accurate?
Oh, it's in excess of 90% sensitivity.
Fantastic.
And specificity. So it's very high accuracy, you know, provided you've not been taking antibiotics in the last few weeks.
And just means breathing into a machine and I'll tell you positive or negative.
Breathing out into a machine, yeah. Exhaled air.
Exhaled air.
Yeah.
And then once that is diagnosed, and you mentioned triple therapy and Dr. D mentioned triple therapy. So would you like to elaborate a little bit about what does that mean and also what is the eradication rate?
Right. Okay, look, if you're positive and you see a doctor, then most doctors would give you a prescription of two antibiotics and a drug which reduces the production of acid by the stomach, something called a proton pump inhibitor, for a duration of at least a week and nowadays perhaps 2 weeks. Now, and in that, if you took the medication for 1 week faithfully, at the moment, you probably have anything between a 50 and 70% chance of getting rid of the bacteria. These bacteria are smart bugs. About 10, 20 years ago, this so-called standard triple therapy would get rid of the bacteria in 90% to 100% of patients. Mm-hmm. Now, the success rate is probably somewhere between 50 and 70%. For some reason, the success rates are not as high as they used to before. Partly because, you know, taking three medicines, including two antibiotics for a week, let alone a fortnight, is a tall order, and many people can't manage it.
Right, so compliance is an issue.
Compliance is a big issue. Secondly, of course, some of this bacteria may be developing resistance to some of these antibiotics. Although in Malaysia, it is not thought to be a major problem. In other parts of the world, in the Far East, for example, in Korea and whatnot, there's a much higher degree of resistance to the clarithromycin, which is one of the drugs used in this regime. So all over the world, generally speaking, the success rates have been declining with this standard therapy. So because of this, people have been trying to find alternative regimes, and there are many emerging alternative regimes now with marginally higher success rates.
Are you not concerned? I mean, this is telling me that this whole talk about antibiotic abuse and, you know, we prescribing antibiotics for all the slightest thing. This is the same thing. We are building up resistance.
Well, it's a big
concern.
Yeah.
What is our backup plan if eventually this bacteria becomes resistant to antibiotics? It's the same thing as what we're battling with tuberculosis, isn't it?
Mm, absolutely. Well, it's a big problem, and I don't think there are any easy answers to this. You know, I think generally we have to be very judicious about the use of antibiotics, but when you have resistance developing, it's a big problem, as it is in hospital-acquired infections and in other areas of medicine. There are no easy answers to this. The industry is trying to develop new antibiotics with different mechanisms of action, which might work, but, you know, it's a difficult problem. I can't answer that.
When you said get rid of it, does that mean cure? Can you get reinfection?
No. If you truly get rid of the infection, then the chances of getting a reinfection in adulthood is pretty small. But what often happens is that the bacteria isn't actually eradicated completely. So after taking the antibiotics and the gastric medicine for a week, if you, for example, do the urea breath test pretty soon, say within a week or two of it, then because most of the bacteria in the stomach has been suppressed, the test will give you a negative result. But if you then repeat the breath test, say a month or two later, what little remnant of bacteria there was in the stomach has a chance to flourish again, and then you get a positive test. So to really know whether you have been successfully eradicated, you mustn't do the repeat breath test too early.
Right.
You have to wait about a month until you give a chance for those small remnants of bacteria to come back. But if you're truly eradicated, then the chances of reinfection in adulthood, by and large, are not high.
It's quite remote.
Okay. How does H. pylori transmit? How do you transmit one person to another?
Yeah, I wish that you didn't ask me the question.
Bodily fluids,
it's amazing, you know. We know so much about this bacteria.
But we don't know where it came from.
The two people who first actually described the bacteria in Perth in Western Australia, University of Western, have already been awarded the Nobel Prize.
Right.
But, you know, there's still major gaps in understanding as to how it's transmitted. It's probably person to person.
Kissing.
Well, I don't know about kissing.
Well, if it's kissing, a breath test, you know, I don't know.
The age at which...
That's why Mira asked me to stay away, breathe away.
The age at which it is has the highest likelihood of transmission is in early childhood.
Right.
So families with lots of children living in poor conditions, overcrowded conditions, have a higher rate of infection, which suggests that it's somehow person to person, maybe with saliva, maybe food spat
does it,
out.
Does it only
like
exist
that?
In human? I mean, I heard a report saying that it can be transmitted on preserved food and things like that. Is that true?
I'm not sure whether it can be preserved in food, but apart from person to person transmission, there's also some evidence that certain water supplies might be potentially a source of infection.
Right.
But there's less certainty about that.
Right.
So it's largely a person to person in infection.
Sure.
I'm not sharing food with you, George. Is that an exaggeration?
No.
If George were to drink from a cup and I were to use that cup and he has the bacteria, will I be able to contract
it? Well, it's 50% of the world population have got it, Mira. You might have passed it to me in the first place.
Okay, whatever.
We don't know that for sure. But, you know, there are certain communities who have a practice where they actually chew the food and then feed the infant.
We do that all the time.
You know what?
We blow and then we taste it with our tongues. Okay, it's cool enough. Now you can have it.
Sometimes it's chewed in the mouth before passing it on. You know, so all these practices may be risk factors for transmission.
Right, okay. Right. I mean, okay.
But certainly there's a correlation between standard of hygiene and the risk of transmission. Mm.
There you go.
Well, okay. Now we're convinced. Then after we come back, we need to talk about stomach cancer, really.
We really do.
That's right.
After the market update, right after this, if you have a question for Dr. Mahendra Raj or Dr. George Lee, we're discussing stomach cancer and an early study that shows a simple breath test could help predict whether people with gut problems are at a high risk of stomach cancer. The number is 03-7710-9000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. It's our Health and Living segment, and Friday, of course, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, comes in to co-host with me while we grill some other expert for
and
a
then,
change.
Then they don't come back again.
I doubt it.
Back any day.
I know. That's because he's in full control. We're
absolutely
just like sitting here listening with our jaws, you know.
Dropped on the floor.
I know, oh my goodness, I might have H. pylori. But is it a cause for concern, Dr. Mahendra Raj? Do you think that we should all be now going and testing for H. pylori and worrying about stomach cancer?
It's like,
how prevalent
is it? Mira is right. It's like, you know, if this is related to cancer, the advocates will just say, look, just treat everybody, you know, 50% of the population. Is that irresponsible?
Look, there are many complex arguments when the killers and the defenders talk about it. And I'll give you just some of the evidence and, you know, just to give an indication as to how complex the issue is. There's a place called Shandong in China, which has a high incidence of gastric cancer. And after a long debate of whether or not we should just mass treat people, there was a study conducted there where they mass treated people with H. pylori infection and followed that population up over a period of about 15 years. And they found that there was a significant drop in the incidence of gastric cancer over a period of about 15 years. Now, that piece of evidence is very persuasive to say, look, mass treat people with H. pylori. But by the same token, we have to realize that this bacteria, if it actually infects half the world's population, there might just be a possibility that it has some beneficial effect.
Do we know any benefit at all?
Well, yes. You know, there's some suggestion that maybe people with H. pylori infection may have a slightly lower risk of gastroesophageal reflux disease in certain communities. And, you know, gastroesophageal reflux disease actually has a predisposes to cancer of the lower esophagus. So there's been a suggestion that as H. pylori falls, maybe the risk of cancer of the lower esophagus may go. It's by no means proven, but that's one. The other area is that there's something in medicine called a hygiene hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
which basically says that if you're exposed to a lot of infections in childhood, in early childhood, then your risk of developing allergic diseases such as asthma in later life is lower.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's one study from America anyway and some other places which has shown that people with H. pylori infection have a lower risk of asthma and other allergies later in life.
Mm.
So that's another argument which is used by the people who want to defend the H. pylori. So it's complex, you know. In Malaysia, for example, the overall prevalence of H. pylori is about, 10 to 20%. And as I said, there's a very distinct ethnic difference. The infection is much more prevalent among the Chinese and Indian communities than the Malay communities. And not unexpectedly, as a result of this, the gastric cancer incidence is much higher, several fold higher among the Chinese and Indians when you compare to the Malays. And it's purely because of H. pylori. On a practical level, I would say, look, if you have a strong family history of gastric cancer, then there's a very persuasive argument
to treat,
to test yourself,
right,
to find out whether you've got the H. pylori, and then treat yourself. You know, you might have the same genes as your father or mother or uncle who's got gastric cancer.
Makes you more susceptible
absolutely
to the infection.
Absolutely.
All right. Exactly how bad is gastric cancer? Can you tell us a little bit more about prevalence?
Just before that, what else contributes towards gastric cancer besides H. pylori?
Yeah, many things. Look, if you're a smoker, your risk is higher. If you have a strong family history. Alcohol, to some extent, yes. Diet, there was for a long time a belief that if your diet was high in salted and preserved pickled stuff, then your risk of gastric cancer was high. In the old days, in Japan had a very high incidence of gastric cancer. And before they really knew about the H. pylori, they blamed everything on salted foods and pickled foods.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought that's why the Japanese had. But now with the H. pylori coming into the picture, we realize that the H. pylori is probably a very important factor. So yes, you're right. H. pylori is one factor, but it is only one factor. And diet, smoking, alcohol, family history, and some other rare conditions such as pernicious anemia and whatnot predispose to gastric cancer.
George.
Right. I mean, so we're all talking about H. pylori in order to protect ourselves from the gastric cancer, from stomach cancer. And this particular study we started off talking about is to detect stomach cancer
absolutely
at early ages,
yep,
at early stages. So exactly how prevalent is stomach cancer in Malaysia, and what sort of symptoms, and then how should we be, how much should we worry about this condition?
Yeah. Well, you know, gastric cancer, I guess the best way to describe it in Malaysia is not uncommon. In males, it's about the 7th or 8th commonest cancer in Malaysia. In females, is about the 10th commonest cause of cancer in Malaysia. As I said, the overall incidence of Malaysia of gastric cancer is about 6 per 100,000 per year among males, which means of 100,000 male Malaysians, 6 will get cancer this year. All right? It's not an uncommon cancer, but it's not as common as, say, breast cancer and colon cancer and lung cancer, which mm-hmm are far more common and far bigger public health problems. But the problem with gastric cancer is, unfortunately, by the time it produces symptoms, it's often far advanced and incurable. So many, if not most, patients with gastric cancer, by the time they get the symptoms which take them to the doctor, they've reached a stage where it's incurable. And the only hope is what we call palliation, which means just to limit the disease and make them more comfortable.
Mm.
So that's the problem with gastric cancer. It's a big cause of death.
What are the symptoms?
Right. When you have the symptoms, it could be just symptoms akin to indigestion, abdominal discomfort. Sometimes you may be very tired and weak, and then someone does a blood test and they find that you're anemic. Or sometimes you may vomit blood or pass blood in the stool if it's very, very obvious. But the worrying thing is many of the symptoms of gastric cancer overlap with and are indistinguishable from the symptoms of other very mild and benign conditions such as indigestion, reflux disease, irritable bowel syndrome, functional dyspepsia, the kind of stuff which many people have. So whether you need to go and see a doctor depends on a number of factors. Number one, age is a very important consideration. If you're 25 years old or 30 years old and you've had indigestion for 10 years And every time you have an exam, you've got a little bit of butterflies in the stomach, and nothing has really changed, then it's unlikely you have gastric cancer. It's something which has been going on for a long time, and you're putting on weight. It's unlikely to have, you're unlikely to have gastric. On the other hand, if you're 65 years old and you've got a bit of an indigestion, in inverted commas, over the last 2-3 months, then that carries a more sinister connotation. It means that something is happening and it could be gastric cancer. So the age at which the symptoms come on is very important. As a general principle and advice to people, if you've got tummy pains, see a doctor. Mm.
So how do you make that diagnosis, whether someone has got gastric cancer or not?
Look, when you see a doctor, of course, the doctor will take a careful history and examine you. That's the most important thing. And no matter what, that's a critical step. And as I said, doctors often have what we call a list of red flag features.
Differential diagnosis.
Red flag features are symptoms or signs which indicate that there's a higher chance that there's something sinister going on.
Right.
For example, if the guy comes and says, look, doc, I've got indigestion, but I've lost 10 kg in the last 1 year, then something serious
Something's
is wrong. It's not just ordinary indigestion. Or if he says, look, doc, over the last couple of months, I haven't been able to sleep at night because I've got pain, nocturnal pain, pain which is actually disturbing your sleep. Something sinister needs to be worked up. All right. If someone comes in and the doctor puts a hand on the tummy and he feels a big lump, that's sinister. Mm. That needs investigation. So the doctors have to go through certain decision-making processes which make them help them decide who should be investigated and who shouldn't be investigated.
Are you imagining symptoms now, George? You use the words gastric cancer, stomach cancer, and the gut interchangeably. Do they all mean the same thing?
No. Look, stomach cancer means gastric cancer. You know, people use the word gastric very loosely by and large. But from a medical point of view, the word gastric actually means that stomach, the part between the lower end of the esophagus and the upper end of the small intestine, the big part which accommodates your food when you first swallow it. Yeah.
Okay.
The gut, on the other hand, refers to the entire gastrointestinal tract.
Okay, there you go. People say you have no guts, and it's used so loosely.
Everything.
And then when you come and you say the gut, and it is the journalist, the gut.
The gut and the brain. We can talk about that someday, but butterflies in the stomach, gut feeling, everything, all emotions, I think, come from the gut.
So, your final take on the whole idea of having a breath test as far as stomach cancer is concerned.
I think...
And we just quickly about precancer cells.
Right.
This is what the study was about, detecting precancer cells.
The study was detecting both cancer and precancerous situations. The lining of the stomach is what we call a mucosal lining, all right? It's a bit of a technical term, but nobody develops stomach cancer overnight. There's a long process where the cells in the lining of the stomach undergo a sequence of changes over many years and then eventually culminating in gastric cancer. And what this test does is it also is able to detect the intermediate states between a normal stomach lining and the stomach cancer. The state which is not yet cancerous, but tells you that there's a high risk of it developing into cancer in years to come. That condition is called interstitial metaplasia, which means that the lining of the stomach cells changes into a form which is normally present in the lining of the intestine. So this test is able to distinguish normal from interstitial metaplasia from gastric cancer. If it is validated, and if our initial enthusiasm is not dampened, then this is a phenomenal development.
Correct me if I was wrong. You said that it was developed in Latvia and also
Israel.
China and Israel, right?
Yes.
I mean, that was a few years ago, right?
I think in 2013, they did the first test on this when they actually gave birth to the idea. But this particular paper, which was published this year, uses two different technologies and has demonstrated a bit more persuasively that it's pretty good in detecting both precancerous and cancerous situations.
Right. Okay.
So the golden question is, after knowing all of this, 45 minutes, so much information, what do I do? Do I need to worry? Do I need to look out for symptoms? What do I do?
If you have symptoms, see a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let him help you in the decision-making process.
As to see, he's putting the ball in your court.
No, it's important. That's what doctors are around for, you know. Don't sweep it under the carpet.
Okay.
If you happen to have a strong family history of gastric cancer, then I think you're justified to be a bit more proactive and actually go for the test and then go and confront your doctor. If you have no symptoms at all, it's a difficult question to answer. And that is the final truth, actually.
Well, I mean, would you base it on, you know, if you're Chinese, then, you know, you would probably take more precaution?
Well, if you're Chinese...
Male, who smokes and actually drinks alcohol.
If you're Chinese and you're more than 50 years old and...
You're not there yet, George.
You were born in Malaysia at about the turn of... at about the time of independence, you've got a higher chance of gastric cancer. If you're a young Chinese 18-year-old born in Malaysia to parents who are born in Malaysia, your chances of having H. pylori are probably quite low.
Mm. Mm.
Does that, are you relieved now, George?
But the easiest thing
if you're born in Kelantan, George, your chances are even lower. No,
because right. It's all in the water.
It's in Ubuntu. That's right.
Would you have a message for us, Dr. Mahendra?
Well, I think, again, I'm repeating myself, but if you have symptoms, go and see someone. If you have strong family history, go and see someone.
Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us.
Well, I have a final thing. I learned two things. Yes. I learned two things. Number one, I'm going to sniff my patients from now on.
Use your nose. That's Use right. your nose.
And number two, I'm going to go back and eat more budu. That's protective.
Just one more thing. Yep. Bad breath. What does that indicate? Is that a sign that you should go and get yourself checked out?
Well, the link between halitosis and H. pylori at best can be described as tenuous. It's not really a proven thing. There are many causes of bad breath which have nothing to do with H. pylori, and I'm not sure that H. pylori is a proven cause of bad breath. It's certainly far less proven than as a cause of gastric cancer and duodenal ulcers.
Okay. Thank you again, both of you, for joining me
today. Pleasure. Had a lot of fun.
Have a good weekend. That's Dr. Mahendra Raj, consultant gastroenterologist, and Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist on stomach cancer on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.